Travolting presents Bobbin for Robin. Hosted by Jeff Sweeney and Stuart Elmore. Covering Club Paradise. Enjoy the episode.
Welcome to the Club Paradise. I don't know. I thought you were going to say something.
No, I didn't actually have a beginning scripted for the start of this episode. Shit. Yeah, well, hi, everybody. Welcome back to Travolting Presents Bobbin for Robin. Thank you for listening to our episode last week, The Best of Times. It was not the best movie, but it was a movie called The Best of Times. Thank you for joining us today by the Harold Ramis-directed movie.
Yes, Club Paradise.
Club Paradise.
Now, can I go straight to what the problem with this movie is?
Please go straight into the problem.
This movie is written and designed for Bill Murray and John Cleese.
Yes.
And they then it stars very, Robin Williams and Peter O'Toole.
Yes.
Now, to emphasize, Peter O'Toole, one of the great actors.
Yes.
Robin Williams, one of the great comic movie stars. At this point in their career, neither of them are a fit for this movie.
No.
Robin Williams is not like a big, he's not a movie like star yet. He's not a movie star.
Right.
And Peter O'Toole like can be funny. It's funny. But like in this movie, he's not like, John Cleese would have like ate that character for supper. And I do mean supper, not dinner, because he's British.
Right. Yeah.
And like Bill Murray, for, you know, whether you like him or Robin Williams better and ultimately think which of them is the better actor, Robin is probably ultimately the better actor than Bill Murray.
But very different vibes.
Very different vibes. And at this specific point, you kind of want Bill Murray in this movie.
Yes, this is calling for a Bill Murray-like role.
You even have Brian Doyle Murray in this movie. You do. His brother.
You do. But you also have all of Ramis's CCTV co-stars.
Yeah, this is a Second City TV like production that Robin Williams is like popping up in.
Yeah, yeah. Which I will say, the best parts of this movie are like, I would say are more so like the Second City guys.
Yeah, when it's Rick Moranis and Eugene Levy just like sitting on a beach, like,
dude,
talking about why all the women aren't coming to them.
That's the juice.
That's the funny part of this movie.
The Robin Williams.
When they're
and
just sitting around talking about, oh geez, you know, those babes over there, they're gonna come our way. Oh, but you know, they're really not so great. They're like more like 5 out of 10s. You know, like these girls over here are gonna come our way too, and the 10 out of 10s. Like when they're just doing stuff like that, it's funny.
And you know, we're going to Miami, right? Miami, we got to drop the weight then. it's really good. Yeah, this movie, as I said prior, directed by Harold Ramis. Harold Ramis, boy, oh boy. Coming off of a hot streak.
Yes.
And not like last week where I said Kurt Russell was coming off a hot streak. Turned out he was really coming off of a bad streak that would later become a hot streak. Harold Ramis is actually coming off of a hot streak.
This is his third directed movie.
Yes.
After Caddyshack and Vacation.
Right.
Which are both big hits and like kind of culturally seismic movies.
Huge.
And then weirdly, his movie right after this is Groundhog Day.
A few years later.
Yes. Well, yeah. A few years later. But.
Yeah.
And then he writes Ghostbusters in between Vacation and this. He'd written Stripes.
Mm-hmm.
He'd written Animal House. After this, he has Caddyshack and Ghostbusters 2, which are like, you know, diminishing returns.
Yeah.
And then eventually he just becomes a director. But this is like really kind of the weird object in the middle of his career.
Yes.
That doesn't really have relevance.
Yeah. I'm confused on like, this seems like a movie that wasn't produced for Harold Ramis, that Harold Ramis just tagged along to direct. But then I also think it's like, but wait a minute, like this, but this does kind of give the vibe that it's supposed to be a Harold Ramis movie, but it doesn't feel Harold Ramis E.
I think the thing is about like all of his movies so far, like Animal House, Caddyshack, Stripes, Vacation, Ghostbusters. Those are SNL movies. Like they're not SNL movies. But like they're starring like SNL cast members.
Yeah.
Making their jumps into film.
Right.
It's your Bill Murray's, your Chevy Chase's,
Belushi's,
etc.
Yeah.
And then he like this is his like one Second City TV movie. And obviously he'd brought like Rick Moranis into Ghostbusters.
Yeah.
And like Second City guys have popped up in these movies.
Mm-hmm.
But this is like a committed Second City movie.
Yes.
Starring a as of yet unproven Robin Williams.
Right. Yeah.
And it's like nobody sees this. And right. then he goes right back into with like Ghostbusters 2, Caddyshack 2, Groundhog Day. Those are SNL movies again.
Yeah.
With SNL casts.
Right.
And I mean, I know by that point, Bill Murray is much more than an SNL cast. But
right.
if you're looking at it between the, you know, comparing the two shows.
Right.
And let us not forget, he ends up directing a movie called Stuart Saves His Family at some point.
Yeah.
He also directed Bedazzled, a movie we talked about on the show.
We did talk about Bedazzled, yes, with Brendan Fraser.
Yes.
So Robin gets this movie because Bill Murray drops out and he's the next person in line, I guess, to get this role. As we mentioned, Robin's kind of going through a little bit of a rut period in terms of his film career. Not a lot, any of his movies have really stuck as like a Robin Williams in this movie.
Yes.
Holy cow. Like he hasn't had
He's not a movie star yet.
He's not a movie star yet. His comedy career is taking off. He's doing his Grammy Award winning special, An Evening at the Met. He's just came off of not hosting, but emceeing the Academy Awards in 1986, a clip of which I'm going to play for you right now.
Present the award for cinematography. It's like a young dude who's made movies with Demi Moore, Molly Ringwald, and he looks pretty in pink. Ladies and gentlemen, Jim Pryor. John, you know who he is.
Like flubbed the name on that one.
Yeah.
But yeah. So, and what he also is doing prior to the release of this movie, which is worthy to note of in the context, is he is hosting the first annual Comic Relief.
Yes.
Comic Relief. I got to go on a little bit of a tangent here. So there was a fad in the 80s where a lot of big celebrities got together and did like humongous like entertainment fundraisers. Live Aid. We Are the World. What was the Hands Across America one that happened?
Yeah, Hands Across America.
Yeah. Like, There seemed to be a, like an uptick in the 80s of like big celebrities endorsing or coming on for appearing to like raise awareness and or charitable funds.
I mean, We Are the World is in 1985.
It's literally a year before this movie.
Live Aid is in 1985.
Yes. That's what I'm saying. That's what I'm saying, man. And of course, comedy has its run too. That's my cat eating the dry food, if you hear the crunch. And he's doing this with Billy Crystal, who he, by this point, him and Billy Crystal have been good friends for some time since he did
700 Sundays. I'm Mike Wazowski.
Oh, yeah, yes. Yes. And since they met in New York while he was doing Moscow on the Hudson, and Billy Crystal was in the Broadway theatrical run. And then Whoopi Goldberg, who is kind of at this point a little bit of an unknown rise to fame. I think this is before The Color Purple, if I'm right.
Let's find out. When exactly does Comic Relief happen?
1986, March.
1986. Because, yeah, I think that...
Color Purple, 1985.
So, yeah, this is right after Color Purple.
And this is when... So this is after The Color Purple. She's just come off of an Oscar nomination for that movie.
Yes.
And she's also kind of in the early stages of her comedy career as well. The book puts a lot of attention into Comic Relief because, like, again, it's one of the big major fundraisers that's televised all over the country and all over the world. And the three people who are spearheading this project are Robin Williams, Billy Crystal, Whoopi Goldberg. In the eyes of like the American audiences, it's almost kind of like they're trying to say like these three are like the American representatives of comedy.
Yeah.
Is what they're trying to say. Huge. Pretty big.
Yeah.
That's also where we get this amazing sequence.
Let's hit the opening, okay? Hit it.
Really?
And you cross. Now. Ooh, ooh, gotta dance. Ooh, 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 gotta dance.
Yeah, Billy Crystal and Robin Williams doing an aerobic song and dance routine. One of the best things you'll probably ever watch.
I find it funny that between these three, Whoopi is the only one who now already has an established like film career.
Yeah,
like Robin.
Yeah.
And Billy have like Robin's probably a little further than Billy film career wise. But then they both take a few more years to really kind of pop off.
Yeah, because when does Billy Crystal do...
Because Billy Crystal is... this year, he's going to be in Running Scared, which is, you know, him and Gregory Hines, like, buddy cop comedy.
Yeah, and in 3 years, he's going to be doing When Harry Met Sally.
And he's going to be in, you know, playing Miracle Max a year later in Princess Bride.
Yeah.
But, like, I mean, he'd already been in Spinal Tap very briefly, so he's, like, in the Rob Reiner zone.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it's funny that Whoopi Goldberg has an Oscar nomination and is yet being seen as like this arbiter for comedy.
Yeah.
And then these two guys are like, their planes are still in the tarmac getting ready to take off.
In terms of film. In terms of film. Because in terms of comedy, Whoopi Goldberg is definitely seen as like, oh, and who's this? It is kind of noted that like she gets brought onto this in the sense of like, okay, now we got two kings of comedies and they're both white guys.
Yeah.
Who do we bring into the third? And it's a black woman.
Yeah.
So, but she does like, immediately they form a relationship and they would be going back to host more comic reliefs that would come out in later years. There's a really good, touching, moment with Whoopi Goldberg and Billy Crystal shortly after, Robin passes away, mm-hmm. That I just want to try to look up here. But all that to say, Robin is also, I mentioned prior already that he's doing his comedy album, An Evening at the Met, which is kind of hailed as like the peak of Robin comedy. This is, it wins a Grammy. Robin is selling out theaters, stadiums. Mm. He's going crazy wild. And you probably, the audience listener, you probably have heard, if not have seen this comedy yeah. special before. It's the one where he's like wearing a Hawaiian shirt up on the Met,
yeah,
doing his whole little shtick bit here.
A diaper. You're ready. You may be a lumberjack, you may have been a Marine, you may have seen blood and guts, but you've never seen caca like this.
So
it's worth bringing up him wearing the Hawaiian shirt because we're gonna talk about a tropical movie.
Yes. I've said this before at even like previous like episodes that what I really find very interesting, this is not so much the movie aspect, it's the comedy aspect, but like I've always been fascinated by comedians like sound tech.
Yeah.
Some have a microphone on a stand and they stay there and they don't move and they're tied yeah. to the stand.
That's usually your portly like Italian or right. like
that's the guy with the beer in one hand and a beer in one hand and then like, you know, just casual like that's
Don Rickles going up there.
Yes, just, you know. That's the Don Rickles. Don yes, Rickles. That's a good.
All
good
right, well,
pull.
Welcome everyone to the ski resort. You know, and he just like picks a guy in the crowd and just bullies him relentlessly. The guy goes home and kills himself.
Right. Oh damn! really different direction. Then you have the guys that like they take the mic off the stand and they're walking around with it. Then you have Robin Williams. I know other comedians use a lapel mic and Robin isn't like the only one, but I for sure do feel like he's like a minority. You tell me if you think I'm wrong here, but I just feel like a majority of comedians either use like a handheld microphone.
Yes.
Handheld microphone on a stand or handheld microphone freeform, handheld microphone with a cord.
If you're going to use a lapel mic on stage, most comedians who use a lapel mic are using it because there's like physical bits involved.
Yes.
Like they're going to, you know, I'm thinking of like a Bo Burnham. I know he uses a mic sometimes, but like there's like, you know, they're going to have to run around and do all these like different physical bits or.
Yeah.
Whatnot.
Yeah.
Robin's doing it just because he's so manic that he cannot stay in one place at a time.
Right.
He has to be constantly moving.
Yeah.
And he's going to forget the mic.
Exactly. And so that I found the clip I wanted to share. This is Whoopi and Billy Crystal.
But I think first we got to talk about our friend and our brother.
This is a few weeks after Robin passes away.
You did an amazing tribute at the Emmys. I cannot imagine that was seamless.
Sorry, this is actually the wrong clip. Anyway, it's essentially just them talking about how Whoopi came into comic relief. She was getting her footing in film, but she was still kind of the new girl in town in terms of comedy, and how she credits Robin and Billy for sort of taking her up under her wing.
The three of them had like an inseparable bond. They were very close for their entire careers.
Yeah.
I don't know if they ever really did like a movie together.
I think Billy and Robin did one.
Mm-hmm. Because it, like, Billy is on stage when Robin wins his Oscar for Good Will Hunting. He's hosting the Oscars that year. And like, he, you know, usually the host like leaves.
Yeah.
And then like eventually comes back on stage.
Billy was called after his heart surgery and bits with him.
The three of them are friends, and obviously Billy Crystal goes out and hosts the Oscars like 2 billion times. Robin hosts it once. I think Whoopi hosted it at some point.
I'm pretty sure she did at some point. All of this to say, Robin is at the height of his game in comedy.
She hosts the Oscars 4 times.
Yeah. He's at the height of his game in comedy, not at the height of his game in film.
Yeah.
Club Paradise, as I'm reading and I'm also watching the movie and I'm doing some research about the movie, it just seems like this is another one of those movies that on paper you look at and you're like, of course, this sounds like very clear cut for me. Harold Ramis and a lot of Second City cast, and we're going to go to a tropical island and the fish out of water guy. Like, this seems like kind of a surefire thing. The problem is 4 other Club Med-esque movies come out the same fucking year.
Yes. They're like 4 movies about people trying to start a club in the Caribbean.
Yeah.
And the inherent problem of this movie is that there's so much bit. Like, there's so many bits in this movie.
Yeah.
There's so much it has to do. There's like a whole coup. There's like an island overthrow. There's 4 different like subplots with the visitors you have to follow. It's the financial stability of this club. There's the British occupation.
A lot of this stuff that I didn't even register. So we mentioned last week you had a hard time paying attention to Best of Times. I had a really hard time paying attention to Club Paradise. I think like I was very zoned in on the first 5 minutes because it was in Chicago and it was pretty funny. And then I watch the ending and a lot of the things that happened in the middle. I mean, Rick Moranis and Eugene Levy, great bits. Yeah. They're doing really good stuff here.
I would like to quickly read Roger Ebert's review of this movie.
Please.
The movie never really comes together, and I think the fault of that begins with Robin Williams.
Yeah.
When the star of a movie seems desperate enough to depend on one-liners, can the rest of the cast be blamed for losing confidence in the script?
Robin even says so, and this is mentioned in the biography, that this isn't during a period of time where Robin will read a script that's given to him. And even though he sees a lot of faults with it, he thinks he can fix the movie.
I alone can fix.
And that's like, he recognizes that as a problem in this period of his career, that he's picking projects that aren't fully fleshed out and realized, but he thinks the missing ingredient is him. And of course, like, we're going to, it's pretty self-explanatory why that is not the correct attitude to go in it with. I mean, Good Morning Vietnam, we'll talk about in a couple weeks here, but that's a movie that, could that movie have done pretty well without Robin? Probably.
Yeah. But he is the sauce that makes that movie work.
But he is the sauce that makes the movie work because the movie
is built around him
making the movie work.
Like, even Ramis says, the casting ended up being diametrically opposed to what was intended. It was intended for Bill Murray and John Cleese, with Bill as the laid-back guy and Cleese as the over-the-top guy. And we ended up with Robin Williams and Peter O'Toole, with O'Toole as the laid-back guy and Robin as the over-the-top guy.
Doesn't work. Yeah.
The polarity shifted, and it was probably not as interesting or as solid as it might have been if Bill and Cleese were there.
Yeah. Harold Ramis would also go on to say, as it relates to working with Robin, just that I felt that Robin had never seen himself. Ramis, who it seems like Ramis would be like, you have Robin, who's a great improviser, and he would really very much thrive with a Second City director of this caliber. But even like Ramis says, like, I felt that Robin has never been seen as himself in films. He's not as quirky as he was in Garp or Mask on the Hudson, nor is he a Schlemiel, as in the survivors. In Popeye, he was hidden. And trying to get an actor to be himself is tough. They much prefer to play other roles. And this is a caricature of Robin that we've already mentioned a couple times in past episodes as being like a crux problem, is Robin cannot be seen as anything other than like a otherworldly character actor.
Yeah.
It isn't going to, it won't be until Good Morning Vietnam, Dead Poets Society, fuck, even like movies like Jumanji, where it's like it is Robin Williams playing Robin Williams with a tinge of like what the movie needs, and that's what makes it work. Robin is so much trying to like play different other characters that don't work for the style of the movie. This is like the first movie where Robin's trying to tone it back a little bit, but I almost think it's to the detriment of the movie. So I have a lot of thoughts about this movie in terms of how it didn't work, what problems it was. I don't have a lot of thoughts about what the movie is about because it's so hard to kind of follow. Did you have anything to add in terms of pre-context before we like try to good dive into plot mode?
Not really. I mean, this is not like a context heavy movie.
I do want to mention in terms of Robin's personal private life that, you know, as his marriage is kind of falling apart with his first wife, Valerie, this is where they hire a nanny that would later become Robin's assistant, Marcia. And if that name sounds familiar to folks who are in tune with like Robin's personal life, that's because like Marcia would later become Robin's second and longest marriage. And so she's going with him on all his tours. She's going with him in a lot of these movie sets and they're spending a lot of time together. Just one thing I wanted to add into this like little side note of Robin's personal life and how he's, you know, doing. So Club Paradise.
Yes. A movie that makes every wrong decision it possibly can in the second half. And yet, I watched on the perfect possible day.
Yeah.
Because this is a movie about a Chicagoan escaping to the Caribbean on an extremely cold day. And I watched this movie in the morning of the coldest day of the year in Chicago, and it was 1 degree outside.
It was pretty
and
funny.
So this movie, low-key hit.
Yeah.
Like, I'm not going to argue it's good.
Yeah.
I'm going to be mostly critical of it. But I was sitting there like,
No, there were
this tropical flavoring is kind of hitting right now.
I watched this Thursday, and this also was happening right at a time like we were going through like a cold Arctic polar vortex.
The polar vortex.
In Chicago.
Favorite.
And yeah, coldest week of the year. Luckily, I was not working outside, which was kind of nice. So, but yeah, that being implemented into the first part of this movie was also pretty funny, I thought. So we start off in Chicago, Illinois.
Yes.
And right away we see the amazing, famous, it's Milwaukee Damon North Avenue. Am I wrong on that? That intersection that the fire trucks go through?
Yeah, no, that is Damon, Milwaukee, and North.
Yes.
That is the intersection. It's right by my apartment. It's a 5-minute walk from my apartment.
If listeners who are obsessed with us will probably track down your address.
Yes, they're going to hunt me down.
Hunt you down. Right now, if you watch this movie in that aerial camera angle on that intersection, the building at the top part is now a Barnes and Noble.
Yes.
That's a nice Barnes and Noble.
And that is probably the one shot from Chicago in this movie. Because then we quickly cut to a back lot firehouse.
Yes.
House that's on fire. And Stuart, I swear to Christ, this is the same firehouse that they use in Spider-Man 2.
Yes. I totally caught
on
to that.
It is the exact same layout.
Yeah.
Like when he's running up the stairs, I'm like, this is the same shot. This is the same house.
It's just like name me a New York street where like the buildings curve around and block, you know,
the
street.
Obviously a back lot, but I genuinely am curious. Is this the same one that just stuck around? They used it in Spider-Man 2 again?
Probably. It looks like a one in Friends.
Because when Robin burst into the house, you know, he's the fireman. He hears that there's a baby inside. Which is, remind you, the same thing that happens in Spider-Man 2.
Yes.
He's running up the stairs, and I'm like, I mean, I know a lot of apartment buildings have the same layout, but I'm like, I swear to God, this is the same, like, structure.
Yeah.
Like, I think this might just be, like, the fire apartment building.
Yeah.
That sticks around, and, like, you can rent that for your movie.
Yeah.
And then, like, 15 years later, it's still kicking for Spider-Man.
It's still kicking.
But no, he finds the baby and it's a dog.
Mm-hmm. He throws the dog out the window and they catch him with a trampoline.
Yes. Very good.
And then Robin climbs out the window. Meanwhile, Robin is having this whole thing. His name in this movie, remember, what was his name in the last movie we covered?
Jack Dundee.
What's his name in this movie?
Jack Moniker. And you know what moniker means? It's like an alternate name. That's what that word means.
So Robin is complaining to his other firefighter compatriots, like, I hate living this fucking cold ass city. Even the dog gets to stay inside the truck. He goes up, throws the dog out the window, and then he's about to leave. But then there's a massive explosion in the apartment building and he gets flung off into space. It seems like very fun. It's obviously a dummy that they just like blew up and flew off, but it cuts very seamlessly. And for a moment you're like, oh my God.
Yeah.
It looked
crazy watching Robin Williams get flung out a window in a fireball.
So it was very, very funny. And then from that scene, we cut to the Caribbean. Mm-hmm. It's implied that like Robin got disability insurance payout that he is using to retire and move to a fictional Caribbean island called St. Nicholas. This was actually shot in Jamaica.
Yes. And
he buys small property and he meets, Peter O'Toole at a bar, little tiki bar. This seems like I the thing that's tough about it is like I like Peter O'Toole and Robin Williams together.
Yes.
But it just doesn't match. Like, I don't know what movie I'm watching. And so listening to them talk, it's just like you could put this scene in any movie and it'd probably be pretty good, but without any context.
O'Toole just doesn't have much to do in this movie.
No, he
doesn't.
And
he's also saddled with the end of this movie that just like when you're making a movie about like a controversial subject or something that's going to raise questions.
It's weird to call this movie a controversial.
No, this movie ends with a very controversial subject.
Yeah.
This movie ends with the thesis of this movie in the end. I'll just cut ahead to it is inexplicably violent. Native people deserve a voice, but violent revolution is bad. And as long as the British Empire is there to still oversee everything, they can have their rights. That's like weirdly what the end of this movie settles as. Why would you bring that up in your movie?
Yeah.
Like what benefit does that gain you?
Hard to tell, man. Hard to tell.
I'm going to use a non-controversial movie as a great example of how you thread this needle. Which is Tim Allen's 1995 The Santa Claus.
Oh my God.
A movie that is smart in that it distracts you from asking a lot of questions about how this works.
Yeah.
You just kind of like you go along with it.
Yeah. Like this guy breaks into multiple houses. Yeah.
Because when Tim Allen does like the first night as Santa, he essentially goes to two houses and then he goes back to the North Pole.
Yeah.
And you're like, well, doesn't he have to do the entire world?
Right.
But the movie's just smart in that it doesn't ever bring that
It doesn't
up.
Give you enough time to
It doesn't
ask
give
that.
You time or any like sprinkle to ask these questions.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then the Santa Claus 2 is a movie that's all about asking questions. That's why the movie doesn't work. I'm not gonna say like the Santa Claus is like a masterpiece or anything, but it's an example of like a middling comedy like this that knows what it is and makes sure that all the questions you could ask are kind of pushed to the side.
Yeah.
This movie is constantly like touching on these questions.
Yeah.
And therefore you have the right and like the prerogative as an audience to ask these questions.
Yeah.
And now you're thinking about these questions instead of trying to enjoy the comedy that's in front of you.
Exactly.
You can't enjoy Rick Moranis windsurfing
into oblivion
across the Atlantic Ocean or whatever.
Yeah.
Because you're like, wait, is this movie about like these
dumb
native
tourists
people being taken over by the CEOs of various like resort companies and how their land belongs to them, but only if Peter O'Toole is here as a representative of the British Empire that ultimately owns the island?
It's very strange.
And I'm like,
What are we doing? Yeah.
What is this ending to this movie? Why does it end like this?
Because there's like a coup that then gets like disrupted. Because Robin Williams like is able to like convince them to like not fight each other.
There's a coup from the natives.
Yes.
Against their governor, who's being bankrolled by like the CEOs of all these hotels.
Yeah.
Or these hotel corporations. And it is only stopped because Peter O'Toole rides up in full British army regalia and says, as the ambassador of the British Empire, which owns this island, I agree that the natives should have the land over the hotels. It's like, what are we fucking doing?
And the thing
here
is, like, that would be interesting, but not in a movie called Club Paradise.
Is this not a comedy? Yeah. Like, what are we doing?
This is in a comedy movie called Club Paradise starring Robin Williams. Like not a toad for this
movie.
What
I'm about to say is, like, it's insensitive, but if you're going to make this specific movie in 1986, mm-hmm. you cannot bring all this stuff up.
Yeah.
If you want, you know, the typical American audience member to go to the theater and have a good time with us, you cannot bring up all this stuff about like native relations, right. Because it's going to inherently derail the movie.
Yeah.
If you want to make a movie about native relations, if you want to make a comedy about native relations, then that is that's your prerogative, and you should make that movie.
Yeah.
But you can't try and sprinkle that stuff into your like comedy about Robin Williams like running a hotel on an island.
Yeah.
It simply doesn't work, and it derails the entire second half of this movie.
Yeah, so I mean, I don't even know like what it's worth to say more about the plot, because a lot of it is just like
bits.
Random bits in business. Like yep. Jack befriends reggae musician Ernest Reed, and that's when they form Club Paradise. And they take a bunch of brochure photographs of Jack and Robin in various poses and positions. There's like a scene where like different like white tourists are looking at these brochures and like, we should go there. And that's where we get Barry, Eugene Levy, and Rick Moranis.
Because like the pitch of like this movie is Brian Doyle Murray wants to buy the property that is owned by Ernest.
Mm-hmm.
Who is the owner of Club Paradise, which is a small ramshackle operation, but like it's run by real people on this island.
Yeah.
And Robin is helping him out, and Brian Doyle Murray wants to buy it, and Ernest is about to go into debt, and so he's gonna have to give up his club. Robin agrees to help him make the money back. They do.
Yeah.
By tricking a bunch of people to come visit.
Like, it does kind of become somewhat of a financial success.
Yes.
Yeah.
And that is inherently like a funny enough concept.
Yeah.
Like there's something to that.
We don't need all this other fucking Civil War business in here.
Yes, exactly. And so like everyone comes to the island and they all realize like this place kind of sucks, but they grow to love it.
Yeah.
There's a lot of bits about like, you know, water pressure and the various.
Like it's not like a up to code, up to date resort. It's kind of like a shaggy.
Yeah.
Shagadelic.
But everyone comes to like it eventually.
Yeah.
They take the tourists on like various, you know, they take them to a nude beach, which is funny how they cut around all the
nudity.
All the nudity. Yeah. Maybe it's PG-13, something like that.
Something like that, yeah.
I will say there are two exquisite jokes in this movie.
Sam.
The first one is the whole plane sequence with the pilot.
Yes. It's like that is a good
I'm trying point. To remember. I can't remember who plays the Joe Flaherty. Who is a kind of, I feel like we've talked about before in this show. I can't remember why. But Joe Flaherty, who is essentially like the first, it's like his first time ever flying a plane. He is drenched in sweat. The plane is like it's flying through a cloud. He has no idea where he is. And like they're coming and be like, are you okay? Do you know where you're going? And like he sees a break in the cloud and he just screams like, there's a break in the clouds, I'm going for it. And he like descends to 90 degree angle and the press.
Yeah.
It's a really funny sequence.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed it.
It's good.
And I was hoping like, okay, the bit here is the pilot just never comes back. But then he's just like on the island for the rest of the movie and he's still as sweaty. There's something to it. The other A+ joke is the governor of the island is played by Adolf Caesar.
Right.
He's the prime minister because Peter O'Toole's the governor.
Yeah.
The prime minister is named Solomon Grundy, which is such an exquisite fucking joke. that they never bring attention to.
No, they don't.
It's great for them to just constantly be like, oh yeah, Solomon Grundy, the head of the island. Solomon Grundy, born on a Monday, married on Tuesday. I forget what the rest of the poem is.
I don't know.
Do you know Solomon Grundy?
Not really.
Okay, so Stuart, Solomon Grundy is like a 19th century British poem. I'm going to bring it up and I'm going to read it. Solomon Grundy poem. Solomon Grundy, born on a Monday, christened on Tuesday, married on Wednesday, took ill on Thursday, worse on Friday, died on Saturday, buried on Sunday. It's like Solomon Grundy, born on a Monday, christened on Tuesday, married on Wednesday. And it's like a children's song, more or less.
Yeah.
The thing is, in like 1980, whatever, the writers of the Batman comics decided they needed a new villain, and they created a villain named Solomon Grundy, who's like a Frankenstein looking ass guy. And he just recites the poem to himself. a zombie supervillain. There he is, Solomon Grundy. And so it is such a great joke that just Solomon Grundy is just the name of the guy in this movie.
Yeah.
Just kicking about.
So like anything else I would pretty much
mention. We're still talking about Solomon Grundy.
Okay.
like Solomon Grundy is in Batman Arkham City. He's one of the villains you can fight in that game.
Yeah.
And so just anytime in this movie that they're walking around, they're like, yeah, Governor Solomon Grundy. Like, it's so funny to just say it, just have that name in this movie, but never bring it up.
Yeah.
As like, it's funny. None of the characters are in on the joke, but it's like, oh yeah, Solomon Grundy.
I just thought it was like a scary looking
Solomon Grundy's probably like top 20 Batman villains, maybe.
Top 20?
He's like maybe in the top 20, right?
Wow.
And
there's a lot of Batman villains.
There's a lot of Batman villains. And Solomon Grundy's just funny. He's like in Clayface territory.
Yeah.
Or Calendar Man's not funny. Calendar Man's actually pretty successful.
I thought it was like Crocodile Guy, Dr. Croc or whatever.
Killer Croc.
Thought he was like up there with like Killer Croc and whatever.
Killer Croc isn't that funny. He's just like the butt of a joke in the Suicide Squad. Solomon Grundy is funny because he's like Solomon Grundy, born on a Monday, and the Batman's like. Kook, 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 kook.
Yeah.
But he's a zombie, so he can't kill him. He just keeps coming back. It's like Ra's al Ghul.
Interesting.
Stuart, who's your favorite Batman villain?
I mean, are we sticking strictly with like comics or TV shows, animated series?
We're talking just Batman in general. Or just any Batman villain.
I mean, I'm trying to think here because, I mean, Joker would be very easy to say, but I think that's kind of a cop-out answer. Probably the Red Hood.
Mm-hmm. Red Hood's a good one.
Red Hood's a really good one. Yeah.
Jason Todd.
Yeah.
For me, it's Scarecrow. I'm a big Scarecrow guy.
Scarecrow's pretty good.
I also like Two-Face is just a great name.
I like Red Hood because it's like, it is finally the answer to that question of like, where do all these other Robins go?
Yeah.
Like, where's Tim Drake? Where's Jason Todd?
He became Nightwing and he went to Bloodhaven, right. A town that they came up with.
Right. I love it because like Red Hood is the whole bit of like, man, Batman's kind of a dick to his Robins.
Yeah.
And then Red Hood's like, yeah, he fucking is.
Yeah. Yeah. Red Hood is back.
Yeah. And so that's why I really like the animated movie Batman.
Under the
Red Hood. That's a good one.
Red Hood also the spoiler for a game that came out 10 years ago. He is the Arkham Knight in the game Arkham Knight.
I will say also, you ever watch Batman Beyond Joker, Return of the Joker?
No.
You haven't?
No.
Oh, Jeff Sweeney. There's a whole bit where they talk about, you know, so the Joker, it's like, how in the world is Joker back? Because, you know, he would be as old as Batman and Batman killed him.
Yeah.
Like old man Bruce Wayne. You know, the whole Batman Beyond storyline.
Yeah.
There, right. Okay. So they're like, well, you should ask Tim Drake about it because he had a kind of a rough go in with the Joker. I'm gonna see if this is the actual fucking clip. It was. Oh, yes, it is. This is.
What's the matter, Batman? No witty comeback, no threat.
This is a flashback.
I will provide the narration.
Yeah. Playing our family memories on tape. Basically, Robin gets kidnapped by the Joker.
Yeah.
And this is Robin, Joker explaining what he did to Robin.
Yeah, no, this is that's the Red Hood thing.
No, this isn't Red Hood.
Oh. Fight it at first.
Oh, I forget that this is like kind of in a silent film mode, so it doesn't really matter.
Just one.
Basically, in this flashback of regular Batman era, this is Batman Beyond guy. I don't remember his name. He's like asking these questions. The Joker kidnaps Tim Drake, Robin, who's like a boy, tortures him brutally until he like turns him into Joker Jr. And then the Joker is like about to kill Batman right in front of Joker Jr. And he hands the gun to Tim Drake, who's now Joker Jr. And he's like, go ahead and kill your daddy. And then Joker Jr., while still like maniacally laughing, shoots the Joker and starts crying while he's like laughing. It's fucked up, man. And that we find out later is like, you know, they were able to like reverse all of like the torture of that made Tim Drake regular. But what they didn't realize is that the Joker put like a microchip in Tim Drake. So then like in the event the Joker died, the microchip would activate and it would turn Tim Drake into the Joker.
Yes.
And that's where the Joker is back in Batman Beyond. It's a good like storyline movie, but man, fucked up, man. Stuart, not for kids.
Thank you for playing along with this. I was very committed that the second I realized that the guy's name was Solomon Grundy in this movie, I really wanted to take us on a minimum 5-minute long divergence about Batman villains. So thank you for playing along.
If you think
this.
I'm fucking done, I'm
no, I
not.
Know, no, I figure you're not done, but I just want to say thank you for like playing along.
Lest we forget Arnold Schwarzenegger, Dr. Freeze.
Mr.
Freeze. He does have a PhD.
The best line in that movie is, you don't kid the dinosaurs. The Ice Age! And he shoots the T-Rex above Batman and Robin instead of just shooting Batman and Robin. That movie... Underappreciated.
Is that the one where he brings out the Batman credit card?
Yes, that's the one where he brings out the bat.
You don't got it.
He's like bringing up the Batman credit card. We're getting like close-ups of his butt.
Bat nipples.
And everyone's like, oh, this movie's so bad. I'm like, you're clearly not getting the joke here.
What's the joke?
It's supposed to be campy. It's like very intentionally campy movie. And people are like, they ruined it. And it's like, no, it's a different flavor of Batman.
Never forget that background extra who, when Batman breaks through the ceiling and the roof, hey, Batman!
No, those Forever and Batman Robin, well, I don't think they're as good as like Batman Returns or The Dark Knight or something like that. They're a different flavor. They're not trying to do the same thing.
I agree.
And you have to...
Val Kilmer or George Clooney?
Val Kilmer. George Clooney, let us never forget, has played Batman twice because he's in The Flash.
I've still never seen that movie, nor do I think I ever
there
will.
There are three Batmans in that movie, and it drives me to drink. that movie is atrocious.
Shall we transition back to Paradise?
Yes, thank you for playing along.
She might
as
well
call this. To listeners at home, know that I've been planning this for a week because I really wanted to take Solomon Grundy and give him his proper respect.
Yes, Solomon Grundy.
But no, the club becomes a financial success.
Yes.
And Brian Doyle Murray and Ernest Reed are like, you know, conspiring about how to shut it down.
Yes.
And their plan is basically like, we're just going to mobilize the military, I guess.
Something like that. Like he gets the people like riled up into committing like a coup kind of.
Well, that's what Ernest. Sorry, I was mixing these people up.
It's easy to do that.
Solomon Grundy and... Brian Doyle Murray use the military to try and shut down Club Paradise. Ernest abandons the club and rallies all the natives to stage a coup.
Mm-hmm.
And now Robin, the white savior, and Peter O'Toole, the governor, the British governor, have to stop the bloodshed. And they do.
Yes.
And then Brian Doyle Murray sails off to a different island that he can colonize. And Solomon Grundy realizes he was played. And then they all just go back to the club and have a good time.
That's the movie.
That's basically it, right?
Yeah.
Like, if we were to talk anything else about this movie, we would just sit here like, what happens is she goes in and she turns the shower on, but it's high pressure now because Robin had increased the pressure.
Yeah. I'm going to read a Variety review of this movie.
Yes.
There are enough funny skits in Club Paradise to make for a good hour of Second City TV, where most of the cast is from. But too few to keep this Club Med satire afloat for 104 minutes.
Yes.
That is this movie in a nutshell. It's a lot of funny bits, but there's no like cohesive movie in here. Not one that you can act, like can easily latch on to.
Now, if you cut out all of the like the revolution stuff at the end, you have Bill Murray and John Cleese in these roles.
Yeah,
I think there's probably like a pretty passable movie in here.
Yeah.
As it stands, this thing just does not work.
No. No, it doesn't. This movie gets 11% on Rotten Tomatoes before Rotten Tomatoes came out, but retroactively got 11% on Rotten Tomatoes. Worse than Best of Times.
Yeah.
And yeah, this movie just doesn't do very well. Yeah. The box office, it was made
a flop.
Budget for $19 million, and it made a little over $12 million. So...
Before this comes out, Harold Ramis is like, yeah, thankfully the other three Caribbean comedies didn't do well, so it leaves an opening for us, and then his Caribbean comedy also doesn't do well.
But you know,
Peter O'Toole gets a Razzie nomination for this, which is a little rude, I think.
A little.
I mean, he's clearly not putting his all into this. He's a little checked out, but
yeah,
he's here for the paycheck.
He definitely is.
I don't know if he's Razzie worthy.
Robin is given a little bit of leeway to improvise in this movie. Which you think is like great, but at the same time, again, like there's not enough that Robin can do to like glue this movie together. So that is Club Paradise. We pretty much already talked about like, you know, the post-text of it all. It doesn't really do anything for Robin. If anything, like this is kind of like another nail in his like film career coffin that Robin is self-consciously sort of thinking like maybe I'm not like the actor I thought I was going to be. You know, meanwhile, this is 1986.
It's not working out for him.
Christopher Reeves is, I think, on to his fourth Superman movie.
Yes, and his career is nearing its end. Tragically, of course, but...
Well, I mean, they don't know it's nearing its end. You're talking about his accident? Or are you talking about just like generally?
Well, his accident, but also like his career is like winding down at this point.
Yeah, because, you know, when he has to go back for Quest for Peace, that is like the very clear indicator of like, okay, so maybe Christopher Reeves can't do anything other than play Superman.
Like he's a guy who really wants to break out of just being Superman.
Right.
But like when you play Superman as an unknown, like you are so established as Superman.
Yeah, it's you know, like Chris Evans had that, you know, sort of fear and worry when he signed up for Captain America. And I won't say he's like doing lots of things, but he managed to keep himself kind of out.
Well, the thing about like Chris Evans is like Chris Evans does Captain America for 10 years and then he does like a few inspirational dramas. And then he's in Red One playing against type. Chris Evans' thing is he's tried to flip against type and play like assholes again.
Yeah.
Which he used to do before Captain America a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And he's in like Red One and some other stuff. And then he just signs on to play Captain America again.
Yeah.
He's signed on to play Captain America in Secret Wars, a movie that I think will just be a disaster. Robert Downey Jr. is Dr. Doom, apparently. Some bullshit like that.
What the fuck is going on with the MCU, brother?
I don't know, and I'll be honest.
I don't care.
I don't care.
Don't really care.
But like, you know, Christopher Reeve has like he's in like five more movies, a few like The Remains of the Day.
When's his accident again?
Morning Glory.
Isn't his accident in like 97?
Yeah, I think it's 95, 96.
Yeah.
But he's gonna be in a few more movies, some good ones, and then he is in John Carpenter's Village of the Damned. And then he has his accent, and that's it. And like Village of the Damned is such like a sad movie to go out on because it's a disaster.
Yeah. I'm next week we're gonna talk about Seize the Day.
Seize the Day.
Which is really kind of a nothing movie. Like it flew under the radar, it was a very small budget. We'll talk about it for maybe 30 minutes. But then after that, we get
Good Morning Vietnam.
Yeah. So we're two episodes away from Good Morning Vietnam.
Yeah, we're like Robin's film career really kind of shoots off.
Yeah. So that's next.
They finally figure him out.
It's within a year because that movie comes out in 87.
Yeah.
Right. And so he's doing like these back to back flop movies. Comedy career has taken off, but. Very unclear future of Robin's film career, but in two episodes, you're going to find that we reach a a peak of utilization of Robin yeah. that will, I think, forever kind of stamp the way other filmmakers utilize him
yeah.
in their projects.
Like Robin, you know, we've been talking about, like, it takes a while to figure these people out.
Yeah.
And like, especially going from comedy to film, it's very different performing to a crowd to performing in a movie.
Yeah.
And like Robin clearly at this point has shown that he's a good actor,
mm-hmm.
but he still has to figure out how to synthesize his comic energy that made him so popular into like a filmed persona.
Yeah.
And Good Morning Vietnam is the movie that finally figures it out, opens up the book for him, which allows him to take more dramatic work and be more successful at it. Like yeah. Dead Poets Society is very shortly after Good Morning Vietnam.
Yeah, right.
And he's not like, he's not really zany in Dead Poets Society. It's not a movie where he's like, doing jokes.
But he does like bits.
He does bits in it.
He does do bits.
But it's, you know, Good Morning Vietnam is like the key that finally opens up the door.
Yes.
To allow him like to figure out his film persona and then give him more freedom in other movies to like expand more instead of feeling constrained to something like A Club Paradise.
Yeah.
Or even A World According to Garp.
Yeah.
And it's going to be very exciting once we get into that period.
It is. I think on the roster I have Good Morning Vietnam being like the second to last movie of his comedian career, because I personally do view and believe, and I think it's worth mentioning on this episode because we're in the midpoint of this first era of his. You know, we do Good Morning Vietnam, then Adventures of Baron Munchausen, Portrait of a White Marriage. Then we're going to recap his comedian era and go into
Dead Poets Society.
Because I really do think like Good Morning Vietnam is what establishes Robin of being capable of doing like real good art and forms of expression in the film world that other filmmakers and audiences are going to see and recognize and appreciate. And I think Dead Poets Society being like the first film into the new thespian era, that is going to be like the landmark film of being like, okay, we believe you.
Yeah.
You're an actor.
Yeah, you got it.
You got it. Like, you're very clearly like an actor. And we want you to do more of this.
Yes.
It's a Jim Carrey Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind movie where it's like they see him do that and it's like, you should do more of that, Jim.
Yeah.
Like, that you were good doing yeah. that. Like, why don't you do more of that? Anyway.
Because so many comedians are really good dramatic actors, but very few are used very well.
Well, small little tangent. It is partly because of the whole thing that, like, you know, there's the trope of like comedians are some of the most like
insightful people.
Insightful is a word I was going to use more like internally, like, I don't want to say damaged, but there's an insight to them that they have because of whatever pain and emotional struggle they put into their comedy and their work. And I think seeing that translate into dramatic works for comedians is oftentimes surprising for a lot of people.
But like Jim Carrey is a great example of a guy who, like, Truman Show really had it all figured out. Then he didn't really do something like that again for a little bit. And then Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, people are like, wow, that's incredible. And then he never does something like that again.
No, he doesn't.
He does shit like Dark Crimes.
The Number 23.
Yeah, The Number 23, where it's like, okay, well, this isn't quite what we're talking about.
No, that's not what we were talking about.
You misunderstood.
Yeah, you misunderstood.
And now he's just doing Sonic the Hedgehog movies. That's all he's doing now, which is crazy.
Handed to him, written in golden silk.
Yes, written in golden silk. Did you see Sonic the Hedgehog 3?
No.
I want you to know that in the end credits, he gets a special credit as being listed as an artistic consultant.
Fantastic.
Like after, like in the crew list.
This is good.
It's artistic consultant Jim Carrey.
This is good. This is very good. I like this.
He plays two roles inside the Hedgehog 3. And look, he's funny. I would not describe it as an artistic performance, but Jim, go off, whatever you want to do, buddy. Do you care if I tell you how Sonic the Hedgehog 3 ends?
I don't care.
A movie I inexplicably have seen.
I've not seen any of the Sonic movies.
They're like fine. He plays two characters in it. He plays Dr. Robotnik and he plays Gerald Robotnik, who's like his grandfather, who's like 115 in the movie. At the end of the movie, it turns out Gerald Robotnik is the villain. Shadow and Eggman team up to like with the Sonic crew to like fight him and stop him from shooting a laser that's going to blow up the Earth.
Okay.
And he slaps his older self with like a big hand or something. And he goes and like flies into like a death beam. It just incinerates immediately.
Very good.
And then young Jim Carrey in the movie with Shadow the Hedgehog's help sacrifices himself to blow up the station in this like thing where he's like doing the with all these beams and the whole thing explodes and
very
dies
good. I love it.
And Jim Carrey like gets this epic like sacrifice moment at the end of this silly fucking kids movie.
I love it.
It's very silly. It's so bizarre.
And good.
It's fine. Like, it's like the Hedgehog 3. Go see it. Yeah. I guess I don't know.
Yeah.
If you want to watch Jim Carrey die twice, have I got the fucking movie for you. But then he's like, yeah, I'll come back for Sonic 4. What's that all about then?
Oh my gosh. I don't have any other that's all things I have to say about this episode.
Yeah, I truly have nothing else to say about Club Paradise, a movie that I will probably never watch again. Unless like I have to watch all of Harold Ramis' movie because I'm a fucking weirdo completionist.
You are a weirdo completionist.
I am. I watched Analyze This recently, another movie he directed. Which is the most Jeff Sweeney movie ever made.
Good.
It's about Billy Crystal being hired as Robert De Niro's therapist. And he's the head of a crime organization. It's just Billy Crystal doing bits with all these guys who... I'm going to show you what one of these guys looks like, Stuart.
Good.
This guy, the character's name is Jelly. That's what he
jelly.
Looks like.
Oh.
Is that guy not a jelly?
He's a jelly.
Like, it's just, the whole movie is just Billy Crystal doing bits as guys like this, like, I don't know about this therapy thing. Eh? Like, that's the whole movie. And I'm like, all right, you got me. You got me, guys. This is pretty good.
That's good.
It's a good movie.
All right. Thank you all so much for listening to our episode on Club Paradise. You join us next week.
More movie about Batman.
Yeah, more episode about Batman than anything else. But join us next week for Seize the Day, not to be confused with the motto of Dead Poets Society. This is a different kind of Seize the Day.
Yes.
You can follow us on Instagram, Blue Sky, Threads. Go to our Reddit, please. It looks very sad and lonely.
Always.
If you are watching this on YouTube, please don't angrily comment under our comments that you thought this was the full movie and you were misled. We are a podcast, please.
We're getting a lot of those.
Yeah, I've been getting a lot of those. As always, thank you for Rebecca for the graphic design and Michael Van Bodegan Smith for the theme music taking you out. See you guys all next week for Seize the Day.